In 1898, Germany descended upon China, and making the murder of two missionaries her excuse, annexed a portion of the province of Shantung. Thereupon Russia seized the Liaotung Peninsula and extorted the consent of China to an extension of her Trans-Siberian Railway to Port Arthur, and in 1900 she occupied Manchuria. Britain was unable to resist the imitative impulse and seized the port of Weihai Wei in 1898. How alarming these movements must have been to every intelligent Japanese, a glance at the map will show. They led to a war with Russia, which marks an epoch in the history of Asia, the close of the period of European arrogance. The Russian people were, of course, innocent and ignorant of this trouble that was being made for them halfway round the world, and the wiser Russian statesmen were against these foolish thrusts. But a gang of financial adventurers surrounded the Tsar, including the Grand Dukes, his cousins. They'd gambled deeply in the prospective looting of Manchuria and China, and they would suffer no withdrawal. So there began a transportation of great armies of Japanese soldiers across the sea to Port Arthur and Korea, and the sending of endless trainloads of Russian peasants along the Siberian Railway to die in those distant battlefields. The Russians, badly led and dishonestly provided, were beaten on sea and land alike. The Russian Baltic fleet sailed round Africa to be utterly destroyed in the Straits of Tsushima. A revolutionary movement among the common people of Russia, infuriated by this remote and reasonless slaughter, obliged the Tsar to end the war in 1905. He returned the southern half of Sakhalin, which had been seized by Russia in 1875, evacuated Manchuria, resigned Korea to Japan. The white man was beginning to drop his load in eastern Asia. For some years, however, Germany remained in uneasy possession of Kiao Chau. 12th. We've already noted how the enterprise of Italy in Abyssinia had been checked at the terrible Battle of Odawa in 1896, in which over 3,000 Italians were killed and more than 4,000 taken prisoner. The phase of imperial expansion at the expense of organized non-European states was manifestly drawing to a close. It had entangled the quite sufficiently difficult political and social problems of Great Britain, France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Russia with the affairs of considerable alien, unassimilable, and resentful populations. Great Britain had Egypt, not formally annexed as yet, India, Burma, and a variety of such minor problems as Malta and Shanghai. France had cumbered herself with Tonkin and Annam, in addition to Algiers and Tunis. Spain was newly entangled in Morocco. Italy had found trouble for herself in Tripoli, and German overseas imperialism, though its place in the sun seemed a poor one, derived what satisfaction it could from the thought of a prospective war with Japan over Kiao Chau. All these subject lands had populations at a level of intelligence and education very little lower than those of the possessing country. The development of a native press, of a collective self-consciousness, and of demands for self-government was in each case inevitable, and the statesmen of Europe had been far too busy achieving these empires to have any clear ideas of what they would do with them when they got them. The Western democracies, as they woke up to freedom, discovered themselves imperial and were considerably embarrassed by the discovery. The East came to the Western capitals with perplexing demands. In London, the common Englishman, much preoccupied by strikes, by economic riddles, by questions of nationalization, municipalization, and the like, found that his path was crossed and his public meetings attended by a large and increasing number of swarthy gentlemen in turbans, fezes, and other strange headgear, all saying, in effect, "You've got us. The people who represent your government have destroyed our own government and prevent us from making a new one. What are you going to do with us? 13th. We may note here briefly the very various nature of the constituents of the British Empire in 1914. It was and is a quite unique political combination. Nothing of the sort has ever existed before. First and central to the whole system was the crowned republic of the United British Kingdoms, including, against the will of a considerable part of the Irish people, Ireland. The majority of the British Parliament, made up of the three united parliaments of England, Scotland, and Ireland, determines the headship, the quality, and policy of the ministry, and determines it largely on considerations arising out of British domestic politics. It's this ministry which is the effective supreme government, with powers of peace and war, over all the rest of the empire. Next in order of political importance to the British states were the crowned republics of Australia, Canada, Newfoundland, the oldest British possession in 1583, New Zealand, and South Africa, all practically independent and self-governing states in alliance with Great Britain, but each with a representative of the Crown appointed by the government in office. Next, the Indian Empire, an extension of the empire of the Great Mogul, with its dependent and protected states, reaching now from Baluchistan to Burma, and including Aden. In all of which empire, the British Crown and the Indian Office under parliamentary control played the role of the original Turkoman dynasty. Then the ambiguous possession of Egypt, still nominally a part of the Turkish Empire, and still retaining its own monarch, the Khedive, but under almost despotic British official rule. Then the still more ambiguous Anglo-Egyptian Sudan province, occupied and administered jointly by the British and by the British-controlled Egyptian government. Then a number of partially self-governing communities, some British in origin and some not, with elected legislatures and an appointed executive, such as Malta, Jamaica, the Bahamas, and Bermuda. Then the Crown Colonies, in which the rule of the British Home Government through the Colonial Office verged on autocracy, as in Ceylon, Trinidad, and Fiji, where there was an appointed council, and Gibraltar and St. Helena, where there was a governor. Then great areas of chiefly tropical lands, raw product areas with politically weak and under-civilized native communities, which were nominally protectorates and administered either by a high commissioner set over native chiefs, as in Basutoland, or over a chartered company, as in Rhodesia. In some cases the Foreign Office, in some cases the Colonial Office, and in some cases the India Office, had been concerned in acquiring the possessions that fell into this last and least definite class of all, but for the most part the Colonial Office was now responsible for them. It'll be manifest, therefore, that no single office and no single brain had ever comprehended the British Empire as a whole. It was a mixture of growths and accumulations entirely different from anything that has ever been called an empire before. It guaranteed a wide peace and security. That's why it was endured and sustained by many men of the subject races, in spite of official tyrannies and insufficiencies, and of much negligence on the part of the home public. Like the Athenian Empire, it was an overseas empire. Its ways were seaways, and its common link was the British Navy. Like all empires, its cohesion was dependent physically upon a method of communication. The development of seamanship, shipbuilding, and steamships between the 16th and 19th centuries had made it a possible and convenient pax, the Pax Britannica, and fresh developments of air or swift land transport or of undersea warfare might at any time make it inconvenient or helplessly insecure.